Well, it is summertime, a time when many people take a vacation, get away from the heat. Lots of folks go into the movies as well. And the new film Girls Trip helps folks do both. It's a comedy about four friends who reconnect for a wild excursion to New Orleans. Here's a clip of the trailer.
We haven't hung in 5 years. This weekend is about us. We are here together. Today is the last day that we will ever be this young.
That's a clip from the trailer for the film Girls Trip. It's a film that is a box office success, earning more than twice as much as it cost to make. We're going to talk about that success and its musings on sisterhood. Also want to take a look at Jay-Z's recent album and an HBO show called Confederate that sparks controversy long before the first episode even hits the air. Here to talk about that and more are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. They join us today for another installment of Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context. Natalie's a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Welcome back, Natalie.
Good to be here, Frank.
And Mark Anthony Neal is the chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University and author and host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark.
How are you doing, Frank? And happy James Baldwin birthday day.
Today's the day.
Oh, that's great.
We're gonna do a whole show on that,
yes.
On James Baldwin. But not today. Today I want to talk about Girls Trip. It's summertime, summer movies. This is a very successful film. Natalie, tell us more about it.
Well, it is a sort of ensemble piece. It's produced by Will Packer, who's behind Think Like a Man and I think Ride Along and some Kevin Hart vehicles. It stars Jada Pinkett Smith, Queen Latifah, Regina Hall, and newcomer Tiffany Haddish. And it's hilarious. It's a look at what it means to have really close friends, to be apart from them. How do you reconcile the ways that your lives sort of separate and depart? And when you come together, you know, how does all of that play out? So I think it is, you know, at the end of the day, what it does really well is speak to the type of sisterhood that I think African-American women, myself included, really long for, and often because of the busyness of our lives, lack. And so it just, you know, it's really a lot of fun, but it, you know, I left the film feeling like, dang, I need to reach out to some of my girlfriends and we need to get together. We need to do this type of trip, you know, on a regular basis.
Mark, what do you make of this? I mean, it does follow a lot of Hollywood formulas tried and true. It's an ensemble cast of an all-star ensemble cast. It's a buddy flick. It's a getaway movie. I mean, it's got all that stuff. What's your take on this film?
You know, it's a film. There are films that I see with my daughter, my 19-year-old daughter, and there are films I see with my wife. There's very few films that I see with both of them at the same time. Girls Trip was one of those films, right? And part of it is that, you know, it is just hilarious. But Simone Drake, wrote a piece on New Black Man, and she talked about the fact it's also a celebration of Black mobility, mm-hmm. of Black leisure time, mm-hmm. of Black joy. Mm-hmm. And guess what? Sometimes Black joy is raunchy. and sometimes it's rated R, right?
That's,
and, you know,
right.
Part of the success of the film, this is one of the most successful rated R films that we've seen in about a year. It's the most successful comedy that we've seen thus far this year. And folks had always said, you cannot have a Black ensemble cast that will cross over. When I went to the movie theater, half the folks there
That's right.
were white.
Yeah.
And let's give, you know, shouts out to Tiffany Haddish, who just, it's a breakout role and opportunity
absolutely.
For her. She is absolutely hilarious.
Yes, she is.
I've got a short time in this segment, Natalie. We can come back to it. But briefly, what do you think accounts for that? Is that something, are the times changing, or is there something fundamental to this film that makes it easier to cross over? What do you think?
I think I'm going to tip my hat to something that I read Will Packer said, which is that people have to get on board with the idea that good content is good content. It doesn't matter mm-hmm. who stars in it. I mean, I think we've seen that with Hidden Figures, with mm-hmm. Get Out. I mean, there are people who are hungry for good stories and stories that are going to resonate with them. And I think that's part of Girls Trip's appeal. It does that.
Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown. It's Back Channel today on The State of Things. We're going to continue our conversation about Girls Trip and Jay-Z's recent album. That and more on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Do stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. My guests are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal for the latest installment of Back Channel, connecting culture and context. We were talking about the hit comedy Girls Trip. Mark, I want to follow up on what Natalie was saying just before the break, the idea that good content is good content, but also, we, you know, it needs to be relatable. And so are things changing in the sense that people will cross over what appears to be their identity or not their identity? This is about me or not about me based on the poster, because there's something in here that does resonate with
I think part of it has to deal with the fact that we're talking about a middle class experience, mm-hmm. right? And so there is a commonality about the middle class experience. I mean, that's the thing that we learned about the Bernie Mac show 15 years ago, right? It's about a black family moving into a middle class family, a middle class neighborhood that resonated for folks. So I think that's part of it. What the genius of the film is that it also elevates aspects of black culture. Most white Americans have no idea what the Essence Festival is.
Right.
And it was a celebration of what has now been an institution in black communities for 20 years. And so white America gets that. I wouldn't be surprised if the Essence Festival sees a bump up next year simply because of its presence in the film.
Right. And I just wanted to hit on what Mark said about this is a middle class experience, because I think that is absolutely one of the reasons why Girls Trip resonates, especially for me. You know, because I was thinking about Tyler Perry's Why Did I Get Married? 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. And those characters, like, I guess it did pretty well, but those characters are not middle class. They are upper class. They are people that I don't really know. But these girls, you know, I know them. I have friends who are Tiffany Haddish's character. I have friends who are Jada Pinkett Smith's character. Probably some of my friends would say I'm the Jada Pinkett Smith character, right? So I could really relate. And I think that's really important. You know, when black films do well, I think that is a part of what helps them to become universal.
To your point, Natalie, I kept wondering, I wonder if this is too raunchy for
Natalie.
Well, I'll ask you about that in a minute, but the raunchiness is another aspect of this, because Mark, you were saying this reveals aspects of black life and culture to that middle-class audience that would be attracted for other reasons, but also the raunchiness and the idea that there's a part of women's culture, of what it means to be a woman, opens up in this. Actress Jada Pinkett Smith was talking with NPR's Lulu Garcia Navarro last week about the movie, and she talked about that.
Why do you think it's a surprise still that women can be raunchy too, that we can be enthusiastic about sex? We women know we can all speak and sometimes act like that.
Yeah, but men don't. Men really don't have any idea what woman is about. And
what we get up to.
Right.
When we're
alone. And we're just now coming to an age where we're having more female directors, more female writers, mm-hmm. and more female producers. And where society is more open to seeing all the different facets of being woman, even for women, because we've been indoctrinated in a certain way in society to believe that being woman is this way. Demure and, you know.
Yeah, polite. And,
polite.
Yeah, and smiling.
And nice and sweet, you know. And so it's still something even for us that we have to get used to and have to embrace.
That's Jada Pinkett Smith talking on NPR about the movie Girls Trip, and I'm here with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. What about this as a kind of sisterhood film?
Well, I think that again is one of the hallmarks, I would say, of the film. Because at the end of the day, I mean, in spite of all the things that the women go through in this film, the things they go through both in their personal lives, away from each other, and then what they experience during this weekend in New Orleans, you know, at the end of the day, what matters to them is their relationship with each other. That's what gets them through. That's what they hold on to. That's what they want. And I think that, you know, in this age of reality TV, where what we tend to see happen between black women is spats and fights and mudslinging and all of this negativity, it's really refreshing, and it's important to see that, no, you know what? Yeah, we may fight, but we love each other, and we're going to ride or die with each other.
It also, go ahead, Mark.
And I think also when you see the marriage fall apart with the Regina Hall character, I mean, I think that's critical because, again, yes. we have this idea of what the ideal marriage is, and it's an ongoing struggle, right? And,
right.
and the film is very honest about that. And in that regard, right, when you talk about the middle class experience, right, which is always an aspirational experience, so working class
that's
folks
right.
are going to tap into that, and also other folks, but also folks who are struggling with long-term relationships. That stuff is real, and to be able to handle that with some sort of nuance, but also with some sort of comedy, you know, that's going to appeal to folks.
Absolutely.
And then there's always this question of what happens when you do cross over, what black audiences see and what white audiences see in the same film. I want to play a clip now about the differences in audiences, which I think is revealed a little bit in this clip when we were talking with the white assistant who's going to go along on the trip, and we're just the assistant to one of the actresses who's going to actually take this trip. Let's hear what happens.
Liz.
Yeah.
And I say this out of love.
Preach, girl.
Please refrain from saying things like preach or go, girl, bye, Felicia, ratchet, or any other colloquialisms that you may have heard or looked up on Urban Dictionary.
I'm not even offended. You're the best.
Oh. Mm. Thank you. Okay. Oh.
Have fun on your hashtag Black Girl Magic Weekend. Girl, bye.
Character Ryan talking with her assistant from the film Girls Trip. So there's always that, and that was sort of embedded in the film itself, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things I think that's also important, we were just talking about the Essence Festival, you know, one of the listeners actually just sent me a text. You know, the film opens with them graduating from a historically black college and university,
yes.
FAMU. And again, that kind of context is important for the credibility of the film for black audiences, right? But it also exposes this wider experience, you know, for white America. And again, the fact that, you know, Regina Hall's agent never quite makes that connect, right? She's often outside of that, you know, is a very conscious way of talking about, we want you to be in here. But, you know, when she's instructing her about how she should act in New Orleans, right, you know, mm-hmm. you can come into the house, but it's not your house.
Right.
Talking about, and actually Jada Pinkett Smith was talking about the audience experience as well, and, you know, sort of how they might experience this. I want to hear that clip as well.
I think it is important for black women to see us having this experience. And I also think it's important for black women to see that just because it's a movie starring black women, that we don't have to hold it close to the, like, this is ours. Nobody else can, you know what? No one yeah. else can.
This is just for us.
This is just for us, because it's really not about that. And I do think as a community, we have to be willing to share our space. And I know that that's a very sensitive subject.
Very.
Jada Pinkett Smith talking on NPR about the movie Girls Trip. So is there an opening? I mean, this is interesting that, and we're going to talk about this, I think, with Jay-Z's new album, too, that popular culture is becoming, has it always been a space for these kind of conversations, or has it always been kind of apart from only a commercial space? It now seems to be the place where we're coming together, apart from a political venues and spaces.
I think so many of the other sites are so intense these days and confrontational. Whether you're talking about cable news or the classroom, popular culture, but particularly if you do it with a nice little healthy dose of comedy, allows for us to have these conversations. I mean, as long as it takes every point of view serious and doesn't, you know, caricaturize, right. you know, perceptions of folks, I think we can have effective conversations within that space.
Mm-hmm. And there have, but there has to be, I mean, Hollywood trades in type. They cannot be a successful movie without some degree of type. Stereotyping has to be in there. And then it's the nuance, I suppose, and the way in which it's delivered and the context. You talked about that, Natalie. So important to have it in context so that you can have a serious conversation using humor, but also trading in type to the extent that I can recognize something about the world I thought I knew.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that that's part of what Girls Trip does well. Like, these women are not caricatures. They are mm-hmm. not stereotypes. Mm-hmm. They are very real. You know, and like, 1A, I just want to say that, you know, the NPR program 1A is about to have a show on, you know, what's real about reality, reality TV. And, you know, I think that what I like about Girls Trip is that there are aspects of these characters that if we were to push them into a reality TV realm could really be exploited and the stereotypes be reinforced. But that's not what happens. We have what seems to be a very intentional effort to make these women three-dimensional. So we see the softer, more vulnerable side of Dina, the Tiffany Haddish character. We see the raunchy, more sexually, free side of the Jada Pinkett Smith character. You know, we get to see these different sides of these women, and that is what keeps them from being types. And that's real.
And let me be a man for a moment, right? Because these are four Black women who all in their real life are in their 40s. So these are quote-unquote grown-ass Black women, and no one would see them on the screen. And very real bodies, very different real bodies, and everyone would see them as attractive and sexy. And we don't see Hollywood films grounded in those kind of women, regardless whether we're talking about Black women or white women, right? They're 22-year-olds, right? You know, all eyes are on the gaze of these very grown, in some cases full-bodied, fully fleshed out women, and that in and of itself is something that's incredibly refreshing.
It seems to me, Mark, that speaks to the long-standing argument that unless you diversify the control over these things, like films, like it's not about Hollywood. There's not something fundamentally wrong about Hollywood that had been in the 50s and 60s portraying images of only white middle-class families. It's that the directors and the producers were also coming from that background.
Right.
The argument was if you diversify our directors and our producers, you're going to get highly successful Hollywood films that reflect a greater
which respect. Is what we see folks like Ava DuVernay and Shonda Rhimes doing in terms of television.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch gears now and talk about Jay-Z. Released an highly anticipated new album, 444. It features the veteran rapper talking about marriage and fatherhood and masculinity. Let's listen to a clip from Kill Jay-Z.
Kill Jay-Z. They'll never love you. You'll never be enough. Let's just keep it real, Jay-Z. Jay-Z, I mean, you shot your own brother. How could we know if we can trust Jay-Z? And you know better, nigga, I know you do. But you gotta do better, boy, you owe it the blue. You had no father, you had the armor. But you got a daughter, gotta get softer. Die, Jay-Z. This ain't back in the days. You don't need an alibi, Jay-Z. Cry, Jay-Z. We know the pain is real, but you can't heal what you never revealed.
Let's clip the song Kill Jay-Z from the album 444. My guests are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal here on Back Channel. Talk about this album overall, Mark.
It's amazing. It's the most, obviously the most mature work of his career. I would argue it's the best. You know, as someone who would define himself as a Jay-Z stan, and as someone who also has devoted considerable scholarly time looking at the arc of his career, it's not as surprising to me. We've seen inclinations of him moving towards his level of maturity really for at least a decade and probably longer. But it's the first album, I think, where he had a whole statement that spoke to the wholeness of what it means to be this grown 48-year-old Black mm-hmm. man who's dealing with all these different responsibilities, right? To a wife, to children, to his career, to the industry that he represents, but also to a broader public that has expectations on him, you know, when they look at where Harry Belafonte was at 48 years old or folks like that, there is a level of expectation that he's now growing into and embracing.
And I think it's really, you know, it's not by chance that the album starts off with Kill Jay-Z, because I think in order for him to establish a level of credibility, because he knows, I'm not a Jay-Z stan. I have really not been a fan. This is the first Jay-Z album I've purchased, okay? So, I'm coming to this as a newbie, but, you know, I have followed certain parts of Jay-Z's career. Certainly Lemonade, you know, brought me like front and center to the issues within his marriage. But I think that Jay-Z knows that there were going to be people that, you know, were going to question, you know, what is this? Like, really, are you going to really try and sell this to us, as authentic?
Right.
And I think it is brilliant that he, you know, dissects himself, that he basically separates. He has this like, I can't think of the term, but he's Sean Carter over here,
yeah,
looking at, you know, Jay-Z and saying, this is what you've got to do. Like, you've got to die. And
yeah,
I think that really speaks to what he's trying to do with this
album. And that's, you know, what he does with the footnote, for instance, with Kill Jay-Z. I mean, he's very honest about this. Like, this is Sean Carter having a conversation
right.
with Jay-Z.
Yeah.
Well, and what about that? Let's talk about 444, which is, again, another song. This is the apology, which he says was not a direct response to Lemonade, but certainly an apology to his wife about that relationship. Let's listen to a clip first.
I apologize, orphan woman eyes, took for my child to be born, see through a woman's eyes, took for these natural twins to believe in miracles, took me too long for this song, I don't deserve you, I harass you out in Paris, please come back to Rome, you make it home, we talked for hours when you were on tour, please pick up the phone, pick up the phone, I said don't embarrass me instead of be mine, that was my proposal for us to go steady, that was your 21st birthday. You matured faster than me. I wasn't ready. So I apologize. I seen the innocence. Leave your eyes. I still mourn this death. And I apologize.
That's a clip from 444, Jay-Z's most recent album. And I'm talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel. Well, Natalie, you just said, I mean, you know, this is an industry that trades on these kind of relationships. So Lemonade comes out. He's criticized. Oh, now the apology. You could easily, as you said, I mean, be suspicious that this is just another commercial trick. What made you think that what was the authenticity in this for you that turned your mind on this?
Well, I think that there were two things, a couple of things. Number one, I began to be drawn into Jay-Z as an artist with Magna Carta and Picasso. And so there's a level of authenticity in Picasso and some of the songs that I've heard, that I've listened to from that album that sort of primed me for 444. But on top of that, you know, it is incredibly difficult for men in American culture to be vulnerable. Take that to the nth degree within hip hop. So for Jay, there's a level, there are things that he is saying. I mean, the fact that he is, self-reflective enough to be able to say that I saw, you know, the innocence in your eyes die because of something that I did. To me, you know, that's not like, you can't just like manufacture that. That comes from a real place of feeling and thought and introspection that we don't often see. And so, yeah, I believe him. I think it's credible, it's authentic, and it makes me, you know, applaud him for at least having the courage to try to have this conversation in public and to apologize and you know, and be willing to be vulnerable not only to his wife and his children, but to us.
Mark, yeah.
I quite frankly was surprised to the extent that people read that song and his apology as proxy for their own relationships. That has been very, that speaks to who they are in terms of popular culture fiction and how much folks are invested in them. But I also know that this is something that's not occurring in real time, just as Lemonade didn't occur in real time. Right? So whatever conversations we're hearing on Lemonade and whatever conversations we're hearing on 444, trust that Jay-Z and Beyonce have already had these conversations,
right?
They've just chosen to share the importance of this to us in some sort of artistic formation. And I think that's very critical and important, right? They are above anything artists, right? And if you're Jay-Z, and particularly if you're a hip-hop artist, hip-hop has very rarely rewarded Black men for acknowledging their vulnerabilities, right? In fact, when you see the kind of shift in Kanye's career from very early Kanye to the Kanye that we have now, where we see much more hubris, the kind of hubris that we would have associated with Jay-Z 20 years ago, part of that is him getting beat up for actually acknowledging some of his vulnerabilities within that context. So it's an interesting moment in that regard. And again, I go back to an earlier point in Jay-Z's career. I'm thinking specifically about, you know, Volume 3. He has a track called There's Been a Murder, right? And the hook of the song is, it's back to Jay-Z the Hustler. Sean Carter the Hustler, Jay-Z is dead. Except in 2000, right, you know, Sean Carter was still this kind of hustler spirit who had a certain kind of street instinct. What we see now in Sean Carter, right, in 2017, is a mature father, husband, businessman, philanthropist, right? Someone who's carrying a certain kind of weight that Jay-Z or Sean Carter from 1999 didn't have to worry about.
We're going to take a break here, but when we come back, I want to ask you whether or not that reflects any kind of a change and whether that can have an impact or whether or not you have to be Jay-Z to get away with that one. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that when we come back with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown today on Back Channel. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on this installment of Back Channel. And before the break, Mark talking about Jay-Z, this turn, this exposing a vulnerable side, a very successful album, 444, a highly anticipated, extremely successful, and yet a real a sea change. Maybe not a sea change. It's been coming, as you say. But what does it mean for the industry? Do you have to be Jay-Z to do that? Or does this mean he's open to space now?
I think you have to be Jay-Z to do this at this moment, because it's a level of success that he has that gives him a certain amount of credibility. You know, it's not like there aren't other 48-year-old rappers out there. I mean, LL Cool J is, I think, a year younger than Jay-Z, though we would never think about that given how long he's been in the industry. I mean, him having this conversation wouldn't carry the same way, because he just doesn't have the same kind of cultural import. But I think just from a business model, it's important because, you know, I'm 51 years old. I'm not trying to listen to Lil Uzi Vert. That's what my 14-year-old daughter, right? For him to have recorded an album that a 60-year-old grown man, for instance, would find some value in, that's an investment in what hip-hop is, that hip-hop can now reach an older audience at the same time it's, you know, trying to attract 12-year-olds on the under end of it. And I think in order to do that successfully, you just have to be real about where you are in your life and your emotions, right? He is speaking from the standpoint of someone who's 47 and 48 years old, and these are the kinds of things that you're processing in your mind.
Right, or not. I mean, there, you know, there are 48 and 49, right. You know, there are older people who are not having, you know, these types of conversations and are not doing the type of, you know, internal work that Jay-Z seems to be invested in. So I applaud him for
it. Go ahead.
And that's where the accessibility thing, I think, is also interesting, because he's also functioning not as an everyday guy. He is functioning as an upper class elite. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that when Jay-Z talks about, for instance, the value of therapy, you know, that's different, right? That, you know, the same 48-year-old cat who's on the corner needs that same amount of therapy.
Absolutely.
Except his therapy is going to be weed and porn,
right? Mm-hmm.
Right, because he can't yeah. get a therapist, right?
Right?
Yeah. And so we have to also be honest about Jay-Z's positionality as he's remaking himself,
right?
And how much that's actually available to everyday dudes.
Yes. No, but he seems to understand that position is also puts him in a place that where he can generate a conversation around this.
Absolutely.
And the footnotes have played an important part in this. Tell us more about that.
The footnotes are absolutely brilliant. I would argue, you know, that if you're not a Jay-Z fan, don't listen to the album and go directly to the footnotes, right? Because, I mean, they're first of all, the conceptualization of it is brilliant, right? Here's an album, I'm going to give you video footnotes that fill in all the blanks and all the questions that you have. And for him to do that, not just as Jay-Z, but, you know, corralling all these very interesting figures that we have investments in, right? Anthony Anderson and Will Smith and, Jesse Williams, all these folks who we have invested a certain kind of importance to, having them also be vulnerable and honest about what their lives are. I mean, that's been absolutely brilliant. And again, this is the kind of thing that Jay-Z can do because he's doing it on a platform that he owns.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure a record company would not footnote. Right. What's that?
Right. But I also want to say that, you know, the conversations that are taking place or that are generated by the footnotes from 444 are not new conversations. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I think that we've been talking about masculinity and manhood in at least Black popular culture for a while. You know, Byron Hurt, documentary filmmaker, he did a film called I Am a Man, like 10, 15 years, no, not 10, goodness, 15, 20 years ago at this point. So the conversation has been ongoing. But again, to Mark's point, Jay-Z has a platform that makes this conversation possible on a much larger scale.
Let's talk about something we haven't talked about yet on this album, the video, the story of OJ. I want to play a clip from that, and we'll talk about the significance of that in the political maturity of Jay-Z.
Financial freedom, my only hope. Living rich and dying broke. I bought some artwork for $1 million. 2 years later, that shit worth $2 million. 2 years later, that shit worth $8 million. I can't wait to get this shit to my children. Y'all think it's bougie, I'm like, it's fine, but I'm trying to give you $1 million worth of game for $9.99. I turn a 2 to a 4, 4 to an 8. I turn my life into a nice first week release date. Y'all is still taking advances, huh? Me and my dicks taking real chances, y'all on the gram holding money to your ear. There's a disconnect, we don't call that money over here, yeah. Light jigger, dark jigger, faux jigger, real jigger. Rich jigger, pole jigger, house jigger, field jigger.
It's a clip of the song Story of O.J. by Jay-Z. Popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal are here to talk about that on Back Channel.
This is my thing, and I'm just going to be frank about this. Suddenly, you know, cats who ain't never really had sophisticated analysis of capitalism or black capitalism get all in their feelings about black capitalism when Beyonce and Jay-Z do something, right? Folks who ain't never read Marx, ain't never read Angela Davis. They know who she is, but they ain't never read her. Don't know who Cedric Robinson is, right? Suddenly they have these critiques of capitalism as they're all trying to hustle their own think pieces for $200, right? As if they're not invested in this process also. That being said, you know, it was in fact an honest assessment of where he is in his career and the kinds of choices that he made, right? He's like, you know, why am I in a strip club? Right. You know, what matters is actually me actually establishing a body of credit that allows me to be able to borrow and build stuff, right? You know, I could have bought this space in Dumbo, right? You know, down under the Brooklyn Bridge. You know, for $2 million, it's worth this now. And if it had been worth this now, what would I have been able to do, right? Yeah. And you don't hear that till you hear the end of the album and you're listening to him talk about legacy and the kinds of things that he wants to leave for his family so they can actually give to a broader... Again, you have to listen to the totality of the message, right? And again, you have to have folks who have wealth. I mean, folks pretend that if Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, that they didn't want access to wealth,
right?
Because they could build stuff with wealth, right? They can empower people with wealth. And
well, it's about cutting off access to wealth for minority communities, particularly African Americans. That was what the project, the White Project, was all about. I mean, and he embeds that in the cartoon because this is the animation of those Looney Tunes racist cartoons, right? There's Sambo-like figures that he uses to say part of the reason we haven't figured, it's not that we haven't figured this out, it's that we haven't had access to it. And this is how we are seen by the people who own stuff.
Right.
And if that's the way you look to the people who own stuff, they're never going to give you access to credit, and you're going to have to go take it. And then when you do, start thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. And to that point, you know, I think Jay-Z takes it a step further, and it's not only how black people are seen, but the reality that regardless of how much money you have, what you're able to do with it, whether you're poor or rich, lots of real estate, none at all, it doesn't matter. You're still going to be seen or you're still going to be regarded as you know, the N-word, which, you know, reduces you completely, just, you know, levels all of us to this very base level. And I think that that's a part of what is important about the story of O.J. It's just like this wake-up call, this alarm that, you know, okay, you can think that you got all this going on, but at the end of the day, you know, this is the reality. But there is still something that we can learn, you know, about how to make the most of and like really take advantage of these things. Like while we're being regarded as this, let's get in through the back channel and get to what, you know, is actually going to empower our communities.
Let's take those animated those images, right, and go back earlier, right? Let's go back to Birth of a Nation, right? And fundamentally what Birth of a Nation was about was this idea that when black folks had political power, this is what things would look like,
right?
That fear of that.
Right.
And of course, we're looking at a White House right now in which the current president is functioning in a way that's not all that different from the caricatures that we saw of black folks in Birth of a Nation.
That's right.
Yet had Obama governed that same way, this would be a totally different conversation. And that's part of what Jay-Z is tapping into. The timeliness of the story of O.J., right, literally like 2 weeks before O.J.
And
that timeless line in the documentary, right? I'm not black, I'm O.J.,
right?
That just says so much about this moment.
Yeah.
Right. And the fact that it's a commercial success. I mean, I want to keep coming back to that not only because maybe he didn't read Marx or Angela Davis, but there it is. And it's in a format that I found entertaining and anybody who watches it. And so it becomes utterly digestible in a way that Volume 2 never was on Capitol. So speaking of imagining a world in which, or going back to, you know, Birth of a Nation, which sort of tried to reimagine the South in some ways, this Flapover Confederate, a series that has not yet happened on HBO, but HBO thought they'd roll it out and tell us about it, and came out kind of badly, huh, Natalie?
It did. You know, I think that a lot of the critiques that were leveled against the idea of a Confederate project, you know, centered around the fact that the people who brought it to HBO are two white men who are the ones who created Game of Thrones. And because of the way that race has been handled in Game of Thrones, folk were like, you know, really? Like, you're going to give HBO, you're going to give this project about race where essentially the South wins, like the Confederacy wins? Like, what is that about? And I think that the critique is understandable. I think I understand at the same time that because it has not come out yet, and which is what the producers are saying, you know, give it a chance. Let's see what it actually does. But I'm one of those people who are, I'm just like, you know, what in the world?
Well, we found out that the show does have black producers. One of them, Malcolm Spellman, who spoke on NPR about this last week.
The project is not antebellum imagery. It's not whips. It's not plantations. It's not a celebration or pornography for slavery. And most importantly, it's not an entire nation of slaves.
Malcolm Spellman on NPR talking about the show Confederate. What do you make of all this, Mark?
I'm of a couple of minds. For those black producers and content producers who can't get greenlit, I understand the anger, right? Because I'm sure there have been many alt history projects positioned that talk about black life, right? We're seeing one that's going to be launched by Amazon almost in response to all of this. So I get that anger. But from the other side, from a critical standpoint, I'm hard-pressed to not allow for the actual creation for the art to be able to critique, right? Mm-hmm. I think when all is said and done, that also shoots positions the possibility that the same kind of things will be used against black creativity, that black creativity could be shut down along those same bases. And that being said, we don't know whether or not, because of the context of this, that it actually might in fact necessitate the creation of a black character that's far more radical than we would have ever imagined because the system would have been able to continue. And so, again, we don't know any of those things yet because it hasn't been produced yet.
Right. And it also, it seems to me, could possibly illuminate those things which are at the foundation of every one of the successes, so that banks today, insurance companies today, all owe their success and their capitalization to the fact of slavery, which becomes invisible to us because slavery has taken on. It is very definitely gone, but there are other forms of abuse that go on in the workplace that aren't slavery. Would a show that imagines a contemporary slave society illuminate some of what's happening in a way that it wouldn't? Talk about Black America, too, which I think it's fair to say may not be in response, but this is a show that Amazon announced that imagines another world in which African-American slaves then enslaved people created their own community and their own nation. It's been in development for a while, so it's hard to know that it's a response. But what do you make of that? Again, another alt history.
I think as long as we create a context in which as many stories that can be told, these are always important things, right? And again, all the times that we've kind of talked about reparations, we very rarely have seen on screen, you know, what the possibilities of that would actually look like, right? So this is an attempt really to write an alternative history that allows for the fact that reparations might have taken place and what kind of challenges come with this kind of development of an independent black nation within that context.
And God bless Amazon and Netflix and, you know, all these other vehicles that allow for these types of projects to take root and grow and you know, be seen, because otherwise, I mean, if we were going to leave it to the networks, we probably wouldn't have this sort of rich landscape of material where we're able to use these projects as jumping off points for the types of conversations we need to have.
And these conversations will or can, as we suggested earlier, illuminate these areas of privilege that have gone unnoticed. I wonder if this suggests that there's an appetite for this kind of thing, that these alt histories suggest that folks are really willing to. You know, you take a look at 13th and its success, and the conversations that I've had, and I think others have had around it, where people have had their eyes opened. Is this now sort of the dawn of an era where people say, tell me more? What is it I'm missing?
I think that to a certain extent, there is the, I think there's going to be a part of the population, American population, that does, you know, feel like,
let me delve into this further. Let me learn more. You know, unfortunately, I think the people who need to watch these types of projects are not going to be drawn to them for the very reason that they're so important.
How powerful is the conversation, though? There was that maybe that sleeping class, people who didn't realize what they didn't know what they didn't know. And when they yeah. when they became, you know, when they woke up a little bit, a part of the population that maybe we had underestimated in terms of the potential for change.
Oh, absolutely. And again, it highlights the power of social media, right? That social media could respond so quickly, and then suddenly you're reading Roxane Gay in the New York Times, you know, confirming everything that had been talked about in that regard. I think we're in a moment media-wise where we're looking at wide open spaces. Mm-hmm. So I have no doubt that Confederate still gets made. Right. But they'll also be in a position, so many other responses to it on all kinds of levels that we hadn't seen before.
Yeah. Always a great hour. Thank you so much, Mark Anthony Neal, who is the chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University and author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Mark, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Frank.
And Natalie Bullock Brown, a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University. Natalie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more about our show at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.